Life Audio. You're listening to Therapy and Theology, and I'm your host, Carly Merclear. This podcast is a space where we explore popular topics and questions related to the convergence of faith, feelings, spiritual formation, and more. My prayer is that through these conversations, we will grow in our awareness of who we are as beloved children of God, learn to acknowledge our needs and emotions with curiosity and compassion, and rediscover the purpose and power of our unique stories through the lens of the gospel. As a licensed therapist and ministry leader, I want to give voice to the many questions we face while cultivating a clearer view of how our faith informs our healing journey. I don't have all the answers, but I am committed to going deeper and walking together. So whether you've been to therapy or know exactly what you believe when it comes to theology, I want to invite you to join this journey as we fearlessly name the complexities of our present reality and press into the hope of the gospel story. So are you ready? Let's jump into today's question and begin this journey together.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Hello and welcome back to Therapy and Theology. Today, we're diving into a two-part series on purity culture with Dr. Camden Morganti. She is a licensed clinical psychologist with over 13 years of experience as a therapist, college professor, and supervisor. She owns her own practice in Knoxville, Tennessee, focusing on women's issues, relationships, sexuality, trauma, and spirituality. She is also a writer, speaker, and coach on purity culture recovery, egalitarianism, and faith reconstruction. And exciting, she's going to be publishing her first book on healing from purity culture this coming fall in 2024. So thank you so much for coming to the show, Dr. Camden. I'm so honored to have you with me. I would love for us to start by just having you share a little bit more about your own journey in this work around purity culture and its intersection with faith and spiritual formation.
Thank you for inviting me, Carly. It's nice to talk to a fellow therapist and somebody who really values both faith and psychology. So that's what we're here to talk about. So my personal journey around and work with purity culture is that I had personal experience growing up in purity culture, growing up as an evangelical Christian, attending Christian colleges and youth group and reading a lot of the books and having a True Love Weights ring and all of that stuff. And I was a really big proponent and believer in purity culture, very much idolized like my True Love Weights ring and the status that it gave me as a virgin. And it wasn't until I had a relationship breakup that was very traumatic and devastating for me. And it wasn't until that happened that I started to rethink my faith, but also rethink purity culture and the false promises of what I saw in purity culture. So fast forward a few years and I finished my doctorate in psychology. So I became a psychologist and a therapist and started hearing the negative effects of purity culture and seeing that in my clients. I got married myself, which was a blessing and God's gift of grace to me, and realized it's not something that I did to earn, which is what purity culture really made it out to be. And then started writing about it and speaking about purity culture in about, well, earlier than 2020. Yeah, I had an article published called The Five Myths of Purity Culture in, I think, 2019 or 2018 even. And that started this whole journey of talking about it publicly. And now this dream that I've had for many years to write a book about recovering from purity culture, and I'm working on it as we speak before we jump on this call. come out next fall, as you said. So
that's awesome. That is one of the things that I think about so much in my own process through growing up in the Christian circles and purity culture that I was kind of placed in, both from like seeing it from a legalistic perspective and then my mom trying to find a balance in it all. Because I think in the 90s, kind of grew up in the hub of it. And something that you mentioned specifically is the lies, you know, the lies of purity culture. And I want us to definitely talk more about that, because I think that's something that majorly shifted my perspective, the promise of marriage or the, you know, application of what purity actually is. So I'd love for us to start this conversation by defining purity culture as a term, and then discuss some of the historical narratives at play. You know, what do you see as major contributors to the church's disembodiment of sex and sexuality?
Okay. Yeah, I'm working on a definition, an exact definition of purity culture for my book. And right now I've landed on it's the myths, messages, and cultural movement to persuade Christians to avoid any sexual activity prior to marriage, often using and resulting in shame and fear as a tool of control.
Yeah.
So my definition of purity culture is much more expansive than just abstinence before marriage.
Right.
I think I still hold on to that belief. I still believe that that is biblical and that that is honoring of God and that that has positive benefits. It can have not positive benefits too, which we can talk about with the privacy. But
yes.
Yeah. But purity culture is more than that. It's the method that that belief was taught and also the result of that, the shame and the fear are the main tools that I see and the main effects that I see from purity culture. And you were asking about major contributors to like purity culture. And I think every critic of purity culture, we do not all agree on the definition of purity culture, but we all agree that it was a overreaction to historical cultural events.
It's right. These swallowable events.
That it was not just purely biblical. It was often an overreaction to things like the feminist and sexual revolution, the invention of birth control, teen pregnancy rates, and then political movements like abstinence-only education being government-funded in schools. Yeah, so there's a whole host of both like historical, political, social kind of events that just snowballed into the purity culture movement that we're familiar with, which was at its peak in the late 1990s and early 2000s.
I love the idea, too, of how you defined it with like, it's the method, right? Like in general, the idea of abstinence before marriage, it's a whole like conversation to have of like, what is the purpose of sex and sexuality, a biblical perspective, but the methods of purity culture have been very damaging, you know, and I think you mentioned specifically shame and guilt, you know, and those things. And I wonder if that kind of leads me into kind of the second question, the work that you do currently with purity culture recovery, what impact have you seen by internalizing these distorted messages? And maybe what are those messages that you're seeing come up a lot in your work?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. The main things I see, I've been able to kind of categorize into three main categories is effects in people's faith, effects in their relationships, and then effects in their sexuality. Yeah. So shame and fear, I mentioned, as the two main tools of control. And those really affect all three of those areas. When we have shame in our sexuality and we're not comfortable with who we are as sexual beings and how do we express that, we have shame and fear in relationships. A lot of fear in male-female relationships and a lot of brokenness in that area. And then in our faith, like I say that purity culture was the main reason for me deconstructing my faith in my 20s, going through a faith deconstruction and then a reconstruction, because those false promises of purity culture really let me down so much. So those are the three main areas. I can get more specific on like what I see in each of those areas, but
yeah, I would love that.
But then you were asking, do you want me to go into like what are the messages?
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. So in my writing, I've identified five main myths of purity culture, and they kind of all fall under those myths. And the first one is the spiritual barometer myth that we are better Christians if we are pure. And pure was just very narrowly defined as if you've had sexual intercourse or not. So that creates a lot of shame for people who don't hold to that in their choices or who are victims of sexual assault or something like that. But it also creates a lot of pride and judgmentalism. And that's what I experienced as a young adult, was just a lot of looking down on other people and experiencing this really ugly pride in myself that then led me to the next myth, the fairy tale myth, that if you are a good Christian and you are pure, then God's going to bless you in the marriage.
Yep.
And that was the most damaging myth to me personally, because when I mentioned I had a relationship, serious relationship that ended. And so when that ended and I had done all the quote right things, I was completely disillusioned of like, where is my reward for waiting and having this pure relationship? Why is this not happening for me? Like God promised, when really it wasn't God that promised it. It was purity culture.
That's right.
So that led to my faith deconstruction, as I said. And then the next myth goes hand in hand with that, the switch myth, that if you do remain pure, once you get married, you'll be able to flip a switch.
Yeah.
Sex is going to be really easy and wonderful right away. And as therapists, we just know that is not reality. Like,
you know,
sex is a learned skill that takes education and patience and work and communication, just like any other skill in marriage or in life. So that leads to a lot of disappointment in the couples I see. And then the damaged goods myth, which is if you have premarital sex or if you go through sexual trauma, even that your damaged goods will want you, which obviously leads to a lot of shame. And then lastly, the gatekeeper's myth, which is that women are the gatekeepers of sexuality, that they need to put up boundaries before marriage and then always be sexually available to their husbands in marriage. And this leads to a lot of problems in the relationship and in the couple's sexual intimacy. So those are the five myths and ways I see that showing up.
That's so good. I feel like I don't know where this would fall. Maybe you could tell me. I think in my exploration of it, maybe it's the second one that you mentioned of being able to recognize what the promises of God are and what they're not. And the idea for me, I think growing up, maybe this wasn't even verbalized. Maybe it was just completely my own perception as a child, but growing up with the purity ring and the praying for my future husband and all of those things, it was almost like the purity was for a person, right? Like the abstaining was for that man versus an act of, you know, this is who I am because I'm God's image bearer. And so it put a lot of pressure on focusing on a person rather than the promise of God to be walking with him and to be connected to God, you know? And I think that was that's a big thing that I see a lot of my girls walk through in my practice. We do a lot of sexual script work and how that impacts, you know, the way that they interact from an attachment perspective with the opposite sex and in their relationships. And I see that so frequently that the challenge of when we maybe do have a sexual history, the shame that just so permeates their ability to see themselves as a new creation or to see themselves, you know, in a relationship that is positive and beautiful and like sex is good, you know, sexual feelings are good. And so being able to, I don't know, recreate or reimagine what sexuality can be after these myths are believed for so long, I imagine is a really long process.
It is a really long process. When I first started doing this work, I'm trained in CBT, so cognitive behavioral therapy. You want to think that it's going to be as easy as changing your thoughts. Like if we can change our thoughts and beliefs, then we can change our emotional and embodied experience, because that's what CBT says. But I found that that is not true. Mm-hmm. And as our field has evolved and as I've gotten more training and experience in trauma-informed treatment, we know that these beliefs are stored in the body.
These
beliefs affect you at a physiological level. And so we cannot think our way into new beliefs. We have to have the new experience to support the new beliefs. So, yeah. So a lot of my work has been clients come to me and they kind of already know what the truth is. Like they know this stuff is myths and they've read The Great Sex Rescue by Sheila Ray.
Yes.
And, you know, they've already done a little bit of work recognizing these as myths. But yet they're still feeling really held back in their intimacy in their marriage, or they're still feeling really stuck and really lost in how to navigate dating as a single person and what their sexual ethic is and their boundaries are. Yeah, still really uncomfortable with sex and low sex drive because of that, or just difficulty claiming their sexuality. And yeah, so those are still showing up in their body, even when their mind has made the cognitive shift.
That's right. And so what do you think, I guess, for these internalized beliefs? Does this link somehow? I mean, I know we've kind of mentioned a few, but if someone's listening to this today and they're like, well, maybe this is part, maybe I have started to internalize these beliefs, what are some symptoms that we can maybe point to, whether they're relational or, you know, mental health related? What do you tend to see?
A lot of shame, again, with sexuality, a lot of discomfort with your sexuality, whether you're married or single. Like, just people will say, like, I'm just not really a sexual person. And often that's because they've spent years repressing their sexuality or ignoring and disowning it. A lot of confusion about what they believe and why and how to live out those beliefs, and if values can grow away. In sexual intimacy in particular, we'll see things like low orgasm rates, higher rates of sexual pain, lower sex drive, just lower interest in sex, things like that. And then just being confused about their beliefs and confused about like what is true and not being sure of their faith and their values. So because it's always been handed to them, people haven't had to do the work of figuring out for themselves what their beliefs and values are. They've just always taken what's been handed to them. And so that's an important part of recovery from purity culture, is figuring out what your sexual ethic is and healing your faith from the effects of purity culture.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I imagine that I do a lot of work around like God image and exploring that. And I imagine there's a lot of, at least I've seen this in my own process and in my client's process, of recognizing that the image of God can be so distorted in this type of purity culture framework that you've described, where God is shaming or not pleased or, you know, punishing or judgmental on the air.
Yeah, when I was in purity culture, my image of God was probably that of like kind of a stern teacher or something like that. Like, if I did a good job and performed well on a test, I would get a good grade in it and he would be pleased with me and I'd get a smile or just like a pat on the back. If I did poorly, then he was disappointed and distant from me. It was very works based, and it very much led to a legalistic faith where I can control outcomes based on my behavior. And of course, there are natural consequences for our choices, and I don't deny that that can happen. I just don't think it's as black and white as if you do X, God will do Y for you and you'll get the result that you want, because that didn't happen for me. So when it didn't happen for me, it was just like a reality check of like, this is not as black and white as they make it out to be.
Yes, absolutely. So for those who are experiencing or have experienced shame or fear, or even abuse within this context, because I think I see this happening a lot, you know, where churches, specifically youth groups, you know, are using messages of purity culture that can propitiate abusive environments. What would you say the first step to recovery is, emotionally and spiritually? Maybe there's even some practices that we can offer.
I think the first step is awareness, Carly. Like, I think that's always the first step to change any problem, the awareness of the problem. So just becoming aware that, like, this is not, okay, I don't want to say it's not normal because that stigmatizes it, but like recognizing it as a problem. It's a common problem. You're not alone if you experience this. And I have a lot of clients that tell me like, I feel like I'm weird or I feel like I'm the only one. But then I realized she made a whole career out of this. So I must not be the only one.
Exactly.
Like, the things that I hear are rarely things that I haven't heard before, you know, so it's common, but they're not normal. Like, you shouldn't have to continue feeling this way. You shouldn't have to suffer. So if you are noticing things like a lot of sexual shame or problems in your sexuality or disillusionment in your faith, difficulties with relationships, recognizing and having awareness of those problems first and becoming aware of, where did that come from? Why might I have this belief, or what is the cause of this? If you can develop some insight into that and some insight into your background, that's always a first step for healing.
That's really good. Yeah, I think it's just acknowledging like the reality, right, of what is. That can be a really hard but powerful movement. You know, I was just listening recently to another therapist friend on Instagram, and she was talking about the difference between like breakdowns and breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like such a beautiful way of putting it, where, you know, people will be like, my clients come in all the time, like, I had a breakdown this week. And I'm like, well, you're here, you're sitting here, so there's a good chance it was a breakthrough. Like, maybe a big awareness came of something that's, you know, you're working through. And I think that's a really great way of being able to acknowledge the awareness of something as a problem is not necessarily, you know, it can feel very much like a crisis, I think, for many of us, right, as we go through that work.
And sometimes the awareness of the problem can lead to a lot of emotions too. There can be anger. There can be shame. there can be grief, a lot of grieving, what has been taken from you or what's been lost or how you've been affected. And so I try to help my clients externalize the source of these beliefs.
Yeah.
Because rather than, oh, this is self-inflicted, I did this to myself, or something's broken or distorted with me. If we can externalize it and see where it came from a purity culture book or from a pastor or a youth group or a parent, or, and often being able to have empathy for that source, like they were well-meaning, often, not always, but often well-meaning, that can help with to reduce the shame. And then it can help the person to either have the, you know, anger, righteous anger towards the source of that belief and to process through that anger, or also have empathy, especially if it were like a well-meaning parent or something like that.
That's really good. That's a really helpful first step.
And I would encourage people to take the quiz on my website. It's called Which Purity Culture Myth Affects You? And it's a 25-question quiz, takes just a few minutes, and walks you through each of those myths and some of the beliefs. And so at the end, you can see which ones are maybe still hanging around there, which ones are still affecting me. And that helps with that awareness we were talking about of people realizing how purity culture is starting to affect them. It's a good first step and a good resource that's available for free on my website.
Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Therapy and Theology. If you have a question or topic you would like discussed on a future episode, please feel free to email me or drop it in the comments. Also, don't forget to subscribe to have each week's episode instantly downloaded to your podcasts, and see the show notes for resources mentioned in this episode. To access more content and join my monthly email list for the latest updates and info, visit my website at carlymarkluyer.com.
A powerful prayer life does not require hiking a mountain to be able to hear from God. God can meet us right in the middle of our busy lives to help, guide, and speak to us through prayer. I'm Christina Patterson, host of the Teach Us to Pray podcast, providing practical teaching and encouragement on how you can make prayer a natural and consistent part of your everyday life. I promise it won't require hiking a mountain, but you just might develop the faith to move one. Listen and subscribe at lifeaudio.com.